Hey everyone, Corey here. Thanks for tuning into another episode of Flirting with Models. If you're enjoying the show, I'd greatly appreciate it if you'd take a moment to rate, review, and most importantly, share with a friend. Word of mouth is how this podcast grows. And if you'd like to learn more about Newfound's platform of return-stacked mutual funds, ETFs, and model portfolios, head over to returnstacked.com. Now on with the show. All right, are you ready to get started?
Ready.
All right. 3, 2, 1. Hello and welcome, everyone. I'm Corey Hofstein, and this is Flirting with Models, the podcast that pulls back the curtain to discover the human factor behind the quantitative strategy.
Corey Hofstein is the co-founder and chief investment officer of Newfound Research. Due to industry regulations, he will not discuss any of Newfound Research's funds on this podcast. All opinions expressed by podcast participants are solely their own opinion and do not reflect the opinion of Newfound Research. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for investment decisions. Clients of Newfound Research may maintain positions in securities discussed in this podcast. For more information, visit thinknewfound.com.
In this episode, I speak with Nicolas Mirjolet, CEO and co-head of research at Quantica Capital. We begin with Nicolas' experience operating a statistical arbitrage fund, where he provides his thoughts as to what makes a strategy easier or harder to scale a business on. Nicolas also provides some context for his somewhat counterintuitive view that the larger players had a bigger edge in this capital-constrained space. We then transition to Quantica's flagship managed futures program. Nicolas explains that while Quantica is a price-based trend follower, they apply a multivariate approach to their signal analysis. We discuss how the approach works and how it contrasts against a standard univariate approach. Specifically, Nicolas shares his thoughts on how the multivariate approach impacts the portfolio return profile and why you may want more or fewer variables in your signal universe than your tradable market universe. We end the conversation with Quantica's most recent quarterly research paper, which provides quantitative insight into the convexity versus robustness trade-off trend managers have to make when they add more markets to their portfolio. Please enjoy my conversation with Nicolas Mirjolet. Well, Nicolas, welcome to the podcast. Excited to have you here, both to talk about everything that's going on today with Quantica and the research that you're focused on and the headways you're making in the trend following space. I've really enjoyed reading the quarterly letters that you guys have started writing in the last couple of years. So very excited about this conversation. This actually came out of, I think I reached out to you on LinkedIn saying, hey, I'm reading one of your research pieces and I'm trying to reverse engineer it. And you very kindly answered, hey, this is how we did it. So tip of the hat to you from a researcher's perspective. I appreciate you being so open and transparent, but very excited to also talk about your background because you bring a unique perspective both as a researcher and an operator, someone who's running an asset management business and has done it in the past, and not only has worked in trend following, but also in the statistical arbitrage space. So I feel like this conversation is going to have a nice sort of juxtaposition in many ways. So thank you for joining me.
Corey, it's a pleasure to be on the podcast. Thanks for having me and thanks for reaching out. It was a pleasure interacting with you. I've been following your podcast in the past, so it's a great pleasure to be here and have this conversation with you today. I'm looking forward.
Looking forward to it. So let's just start with background. I gave a little bit of it away saying, again, you've operated on both sides of the fence. And in your past, you've got a deep, dark history of that arb, and you've now seen the light and moved to trend following. But maybe you can walk people through a bit of your background to take us through how you got into the seat you're sitting in today.
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. It was a pleasure. I mean, I initially graduated as an electrical engineer from a French engineering school and as well here from the Federal Institute of Technology in Zurich, which is quite famous in the engineering space. And I started a bit by coincidence working as an analyst for a local quant advisory shop that brought me after a couple of years into a much larger family offices, which really opened up a lot of doors. To make a long story short, we got given the opportunity with the quant unit there back then. It was around 2010-11 to spin out of that family offices and to launch an independent asset management business. It was a great opportunity, which we did. And I was there, the CIO and one of the portfolio managers for about 8 years. Was an incredible experience building an asset management business from scratch. That meant developing a trading strategy. I mean, back then, as you alluded to, as engineers, we were attracted and driven towards statistical arbitrage, which is a strategy that provides a lot of degrees of freedom. We designed a strategy that got seeded, and I was managing this and further developing it for about 8 years. Essentially, that shaped, obviously, what I've been doing. I've evolved after that and got hired by Quantica, by Quantica's founder, Dr. Bruno Gmür. Today, I'm the co-head of research and CEO at Quantica, which puts me basically at the intersection between leading the innovation effort and the research effort of the company and as well interacting with our global investor base. On a day-to-day basis, that also means that I work very closely together with Bruno on both the research side and the business side. But my role basically is to lead the business growth here at Quantica. I've been doing that essentially for the past 5 years. So in summary, yeah, I've been all my professional life in systematic investing, acting as a quantitative researcher and investment manager of systematic investment strategies across the whole trading frequency spectrum over the past 20 years and basically evolving maybe, yeah, from short-term trading focused on convergent type of strategies towards longer-term divergent style strategies such as trend following out of conviction and a long learning process.
Well, so before we even talk the strategy side, I want to talk a little bit of business because, again, you've operated both as researcher and operator. And early on in our pre-call in preparation for this interview, you said, quote, "It's tough to scale an independent business on statistical arbitrage." Why was this the case? And how would you generalize that view? What makes a strategy something that's easier or harder to scale a business on?
Yeah, exactly. So happy to comment on that. I think the reason why that is the case, and it is even more the case today than it used to be a few years ago, is that statistical arbitrage is inherently a strategy that is short term. So it means your typical average holding period for this type of strategy can range anywhere between 1 and 10 days. It's just a rough estimate, can be shorter term, a bit longer term, but let's say 1 and 10 days. So that implies that you will trade a lot. You will have a high turnover. And the more turnover you have, the more focused you will be on your trade execution costs. So the trade execution, the shorter term you are, the more trade execution costs become an integral part of the alpha you are delivering. And the turnover and the costs that you generate are essentially driven by two factors. Number one, it's obviously, as we said, the average holding period. So the shorter your average holding period, the more turnover you will have, the more costs you will face, the more liquidity you will consume out of the markets you trade. And then there's a second factor that is not to be forgotten, that's your gross exposure. So the more gross exposure you need to run or your alpha consumes, the more turnover you will face, obviously, because you will trade more notional in terms of notional. And so one of the key metrics you look at when you manage a statistical arbitrage strategy is your return on gross exposure. That metric is actually a nice metric because it summarizes very well what you're doing. How much alpha can you extract per unit of gross exposure? And this is also a good proxy for the scalability of your trading strategy because the higher this number is, the more scalable your strategy is, basically. But obviously, the challenge is that achieving a high return on gross, that's kind of the challenge, right? And if you achieve that, you have a very good strategy that is scalable. So the question is, how can you achieve, or at least in my view, what's the drivers of achieving a high return on gross exposure? And for that purpose, I think it helps distinguishing between two types of alphas that you can extract at that scale. I mean, I don't mean to be here exhaustive, but the way I saw it, or we saw, is that you have the idiosyncratic alpha. That's the alpha that is left after you neutralize, filter out for all the systematic risk factors. Think of it as simple as directional market exposure, for instance, but there are plenty of others. You don't want to have exposure and you are left with that pure, nice alpha, at least initially from a pure engineering perspective, that's quite attractive when you get to that. The problem is that obviously it comes with a cost and it's very demanding in terms of how much gross exposure it consumes because obviously it's the residual element. So if you want to generate, I mean, it tends to deliver a good Sharpe ratio, but the absolute level of returns you get is quite low, right? So you need to scale it up. And this is where the gross exposure comes into play. So, and like the amount of shares you need to trade if you trade the stocks. So that's why I think the other source of alpha, which is actually capitalizing on systematic risk factor inefficiencies, is also very important. The thing is, you don't want to have static exposure to these, right? You need some dynamic element of it. And I think that's the secret to it. I think you need to combine idiosyncratic sources of alpha and the dynamic exposure to more systematic risk factors. So you need some timing ability there. And then obviously you get this nice balance between good risk-adjusted returns, attractive risk-adjusted independent returns, as well as enough risk exposure to not consume too much of your gross exposure. And I think that's the secret to scale, obviously, an asset management business. And it's just not trivial. And here, the larger players, I think, especially over the past 5 to 7 years, have gained increasingly an advantage.
So I think that's a really counterintuitive point, that the larger players would gain an advantage in what would typically be considered a capital constrained place, which I think the intuition is that smaller parties, that's actually where they have an advantage. That's often where it's discussed. You as a nimble small party can play because these large parties have too much capital to put into effort. How are they gaining an advantage in that space versus the small players?
You are totally right. That might sound counterintuitive at first. The intuition, obviously, is that at smaller scale, there are many areas in the market, especially in that statistical arbitrage space, where you can absolutely compete with the large player. I don't disagree with that. If you're into prop trading, there are many strategies that are actually fantastic if you trade them on your own account. But when we are talking about an asset management business, you need some sort of scale one way or another, right? You need to scale it in order to make it a business. And this is where it becomes more tricky, because then you get face to face with the larger players. They have some structural advantages. The first of these advantages is the breadth of alphas they can deploy, which by construction will have a hard time to compete with simply because they have a lot more researchers. I'm not saying that the amount of alpha you extract is proportional to the number of researchers you have. I tend to be rather skeptical with that, but still, they have incredible breadth. They can replace the traders depending on how they are structured, but that ability obviously is an advantage. You cannot negate that. And the shorter term you are, also my experience is that obviously alpha degradation is quite large, tends to be quite large. So you cannot just rely on an alpha you are harvesting and just think it's going to stay there forever. The reality is that your margin on any alpha is shrinking over time. And the good thing when you do short-term trading is that you can measure it in a way, like how much you can extract. Again, that's your return on gross. And when you trade a lot, you get a lot of data points, which gives you a bit of an idea of how well you're doing. So you continuously need to reinvent yourself. And that's just a reality where the bigger players have an advantage. And then I think there's another aspect which relates more to trade execution, is that I believe one source of alpha from larger players, or think of it as well more the multi-strat types of structures, they can net a lot of the trades. And that saves you just execution costs, which you cannot as a standalone portfolio manager, or not to the same extent. And that's just something you save every day. If it's just a fraction of a basis point for some trades, it stacks up, it compounds, and makes a difference in the long term. There's also a third factor, I think, that is not to be underestimated, is like how you utilize your cash and the cross-utilization of your cash balances across strategies. That's all the benefits you get when you run a larger breadth of strategies when you're a larger group. I come from that perspective, and those were my observations a few years ago, but I think it has gone even more extreme over the last couple of years, and I think it's unrealistic to think that you can compete. I'm insisting here on the shorter term frequency level that you can compete with these larger groups today because there are simply a lot more resources. So at larger scale, I think it's difficult, yeah.
So I want to jump forward to 2019. You were hired as the CEO of Quantica, and I want to spend the majority of this conversation talking about what you do at Quantica today. And so I wanted to start that conversation with a brief overview of Quantica's flagship managed futures program that has been running, I believe, close to 20 years now. And I was hoping you could give an idea of markets traded, types of signals employed, the horizons that are focused on, and maybe even a little bit of color about how the program has evolved over time.
Yeah, sure, absolutely. Maybe it helps also give the reasons why I decided to move from StatArb to Quantica. I think that was a bit the result of my experience trading these shorter term strategies. And there were mainly three reasons that drove me to join the firm. The first is the strategy itself. So trend following, it has, I believe, all the ingredients and the characteristics of an investment strategy that is well suited to build, let's say, an independent asset management firm that you can scale, actually. So just on the topic we just discussed, and maybe as opposed to the shorter term strategies. And those features, characteristics, is that, first of all, trend following has a decade-long track record. I mean, the first trend follower CTAs date back to the early 80s. And they have been generating attractive risk-adjusted returns that are uncorrelated to traditional assets for decades, right? I mean, there is so many numbers that show that. So it's quite convincing, that convexity profile that you generate. So that's one thing. Second, it's highly liquid. It's a super liquid strategy, so you can scale it, right? You trade the most liquid futures in the world. So there is a lot of capacity that you can deploy. And it relies also on a simple hypothesis, which makes it very robust, right? Trend following relies on the premise that, like, identification of price moves that tend to persist, and that persistence is the hypothesis you rely on. So unlike shorter term strategies, statistical arbitrage strategies, where you do a lot of optimization, you continuously look for new alpha sources, you need a certain breadth of different signals to compete. Trend following is very different from that perspective. And because I'm talking here more about the longer term trend following approach, if you do it well, I believe you do not optimize too much. That's probably a bad idea. So it's very different. And that's a feature that I like very much, because obviously the inefficiency behind trend following is very well documented. You have many different explanations. But I think there are some strong reasons to believe that these inefficiencies are still present very much today than they were 20, 30 years ago. So that was the first reason. And then the second reason is that Quantica obviously has a track record with, I mean, a 15-year track record back then when I joined, of providing trend, obviously a very nice trend program with a strong track record, but also with a differentiated approach. Because there's no point, right, running a business if you are just replicating what the larger players is doing. You will have a very tough time, I believe. I was always very admirative of what Bruno, Quantica's founder, had achieved over the years, and that very clear positioning. So that was the second reason. And the third reason is simply also Bruno himself as the founder and CIO. I mean, he's quite known here in Switzerland. You know, the hedge fund space in Switzerland is not super large, so you tend to know each other. And I had always a lot of respect also for the business that he had built. So with that being said, what's the Quantica Managed Futures all about? So as you mentioned, we have a close to 20-year track record this year. Actually, it will reach the 20-year milestone at the end of the year. It was launched in 2005 as a medium to long-term trend following approach. And it has been very style consistent over the years, I may say. So the approach that we trade today is still very consistent, very similar at its core on how Bruno launched the initial program back in 2005. So we focus on the most liquid commodity markets and financial markets globally. We trade around 100 markets today. Liquidity has always been a focus. So we want a homogeneous investment universe in terms of the liquidity. We don't go. The idea is not to trade as many markets as possible necessarily. So we want to keep a nice liquidity profile in terms of the investment universe. And the frequency is medium to long-term trend. The best trends for us are those that run for at least a quarter, to put it that way, right? So this is where it becomes interesting. We are not interested in the shorter-term dynamics for a number of reasons. And we only trade in futures markets, so no OTC exposures. It provides a very clean counterparty risk profile. So highly liquid, only futures, and medium to long-term trend following. Now, what makes it specific is that we run a very differentiated approach to measuring trends, and that's the DNA of Quantica. So it enables us to provide clients. The mission of Quantica is to provide pure trend following return, so you know what you get, but differentiated. So it can act as a very nice complement, for instance, to a portfolio of traditional assets or as well other portfolio of CTAs, for instance. The program's correlation to typical trend benchmarks is around 0.7. So that number can be seen as high or low. It's, I would say, high enough to be clearly identified as a trend follower. So we want to provide all the benefits of trend following returns. We don't want to dilute that. We are not interested in necessarily lowering that correlation. At the same time, 0.7 is not too high, meaning that we are not just a replication of some blue chip trend following strategies out there.
I'm sure I have at least a couple listeners who are chuckling knowing that I spend most of my time thinking about replication of blue chip trend following strategies. But I certainly appreciate that managed futures and trend following is a space where there's huge degrees of freedom in how a portfolio can be built. You can have several people who are relying on the same market phenomenon who trade different markets at different speeds with different trend following signals. And you really identified that trend following signal component being what's unique to Quantica's program, and not just in how you measure trends necessarily, not in the sort of we use regression versus other people use total returns. You guys actually take a multivariate approach versus the traditional univariate approach. And I was hoping you could explain a little bit more about how this multivariate approach works and why you guys choose to employ it versus the more traditional academic univariate approach.
Yes, sure. So maybe, yeah, it helps starting with what most people understand with trend following, how they interpret trend following, right? Trend following goes usually as follows. If we take a single instrument, it's about measuring the recent performance of that instrument. and taking a position along that direction. So if the price of my instrument currently is very high versus the historical distribution over the past 250 days, for instance, you will go long. And if it's on the very negative side or on the left side, you will go short. You're just for volatility. You may use different trend signals, technical indicators, but in the end, that's the philosophy. So you're always following the trends. You're following the direction of the price. And there is enough evidence, historical evidence, empirical evidence that there is a risk premium here, a risk premium to be harvested for taking these positions, which you can argue should maybe not be possible if markets were truly efficient, but that has been the case. So at Quantica, we basically seek to capitalize on the same trend risk premium than what traditional trend following provides you, but with a relative approach to looking at the markets. That's what we call multivariate approach to trend following, or relative risk adjusted approach to measuring trends. And the initial motivation behind that was to actually look at the markets from a capital flow perspective. Obviously, capital is moving from one instrument to another, one asset class to another. It's getting reallocated from one investment opportunity to the next. And the question was, okay, how can we model those capital flows? And one way is to look at relative risk-adjusted returns between all these instruments. And that's one way of measuring relative price pressures between investment opportunities that see capital outflows relative to other instruments that see capital inflows. The price in the end gathers or summarizes a lot of the information out there. So like many trend followers, we rely on prices. But the main difference is really that instead of just looking at each instrument on its own and just looking at where does the price lie of my instrument relative to its history, we look at the recent price evolution of each instrument relative to the price dynamics of all the other instruments in our investment universe, so those 100 markets. That's where the term multivariate comes from, or the relative approach is coming from, is that instead of just looking at a single indicator of trend, we look at, let's say, if you have 100 instruments, we'll look at 99 different pairs and measure the trend on these pairs. So it gives you a more diversified view about the trend strengths of an instrument that will also incorporate, for that purpose, the covariance or correlation structure of these markets, because you start obviously looking at relative return dynamics between these different instruments.
How does this approach end up being different than just, say, traditional cross-sectional momentum?
So we get asked that question quite sometimes, and you could essentially think of this approach as cross-sectional. But in reality, if we think about what cross-sectional momentum is about, cross-sectional momentum is something that's pretty standard in the equity space. So you measure, for instance, the 12-month momentum indicator for every stock in your investment universe, and you cross-normalize that. So for a given point in time, across all the instruments that compose your investment universe. One thing that is worth mentioning is that when you do that across a universe of 100 futures, like we do, like the typical CTA investment universe, the cross-sectional momentum measured in that way is not so different from time series momentum. Because you can think of it that the average correlation between all the futures that you trade in a CTA is relatively low. So when you cross-normalize, think of it as just the average between the performance of all these markets, it's not going to make a very big difference compared to the time series momentum that enters into that measure. So you have a relationship that cross-sectional momentum will deviate more relative to time series momentum the more correlated the constituents are of your investment universe. So if you look at it on an asset class by asset class basis, in a CTA universe, you tend to have the highest correlation, the highest cross correlation in the equity space. And so when you do cross-sectional momentum per asset class, if you compare time series momentum and cross-sectional momentum, you will have to see the largest difference in terms of the information you capture on equities. And then on commodities, which have the lowest cross correlation between the constituents, you will see less of a difference. So it's not completely trivial to exploit cross-asset information from a trend perspective, because if you look at it at the entire universe, it's not really different. So just in a purely standard way, it doesn't really make a difference. And on an asset class by asset class basis, you get to capture different information elements, but you are missing the cross-asset class information because you do it asset class by asset class. And this is, in a way, how you can see the approach that we have chosen to trends, which is a multidimensional and cross-sectional approach, which is a mix between time series and cross-sectional momentum, where you compare each instrument in the universe with any other instrument in the universe. So you look at all the possible pair combinations that you can form out of the 100 instruments that compose the investment universe. And ultimately, what is interesting is that the amount of cross-sectional and the amount of time series momentum that feeds in the end into the signal varies heavily across time and depending a bit on the market environment you are in. And that, we believe, is one of the interesting characteristics of the approach, because it allows you to combine the benefits of both time series and cross-sectional trend information.
Well, maybe you can talk a little bit about those benefits. You mentioned that this approach injects correlation into the trend signal itself. And I guess the rational follow-up question is, well, why is that an attractive property, both from the signal perspective and then maybe thinking about as those signals bubble up to the portfolio perspective, and we talk about the performance characteristics of the portfolio. Again, why is that injection of correlation useful when it comes to the portfolio results?
So there are 2 points. From a signal perspective, first of all, it's a relatively intuitive benefit if you think in terms of the amount of signals you are generating in both cases. So if we call the traditional trend following approach a univariate approach, you run a signal for each instrument. So you replicate your approach. Usually you replicate the same approach across each of the instruments. So for the first instrument, you get one signal, the second and so on. So you have 100 signals at the end. That's a signal generation stage. And again, here I'm really taking the most simple example of trend following, which allows you to basically capture the basic features of the trend following returns. In the multivariate approach, for every instrument, you will generate an amount of different pairs. So if we have 100 instruments in our investment universe, we'll generate 99 different pairs of instruments. So we'll measure the cumulative relative returns between these different pairs and apply the trend on these new return time series. And that provides you with 99 different trend scores, if you want, for your first instrument. We are just looking at the first instrument here. And then you repeat the same process. So here we are no different. We repeat n times the process for each instrument in the universe, which gives you 100 times 99 different pairs. So with 100 instruments, you have close to 10,000 different signals in the end that you can operate on. So we see it as a more general, more robust way to approach trend, more diversified way as well. Gonna get, let's say, necessarily the same output as with a univariate approach. And the overlap between those two approaches may actually vary over time, obviously, because it's not completely independent. It's not like, I'm not claiming here, obviously, that we are generating 10,000 independent signals. Sometimes we are generating nothing different than a univariate approach, but that will obviously depend on the market environment. But the main difference from a signal perspective and what we like is that we are talking here about 10,000 different signals versus 100. So yeah, we see it as a bit more robust way to measure the trend of each instrument. On the performance side, on the second point that you allude to here, the way we look at it is, there's this general principle that the expected Sharpe ratio of a trading strategy is a function of essentially two main ingredients. The average Sharpe ratio that you generate on each single instrument with your strategy. So what's the average Sharpe ratio of trend following on one instrument? And the average cross correlation between the trend P&L that you generate across all your instruments. And obviously, then there's also the third factor, which is the number of instruments you apply your strategy on. So that's a well-known principle. And when you look at what we do, so the difference between multivariate and univariate trend following, where does it benefit in terms of that equation? Are we generating a higher Sharpe ratio per instrument thanks to this multivariate approach, right? So we are injecting a bit more complexity into a signal. What do we get out of that? You need something for it, right? Otherwise, you stick with the simple approach. So the answer is that we do not improve the average Sharpe ratio per instrument. So a multivariate approach doesn't lead to a higher Sharpe ratio. You can think of trend following, or the way, that's our subjective view, but we think that the average Sharpe ratio, a realistic Sharpe ratio you can expect on average from a trend strategy on a single instrument is anywhere between 0.2 and 0.25. It's not very high. So we don't generate much higher values on that. Where the strategy has proved to be quite efficient is at generating lower cross correlation between the different instruments and quite consistently over the past 20 years. So we can show that relative to a univariate approach, a multivariate approach or a relative approach is leading to a lower cross correlation between the trend P&Ls we generate on each single instrument. And we are talking roughly about 0.05 points of correlation, lower correlation. That seems low, but that's on a per instrument basis. When you apply it to 103 instruments, that translates into something like 0.2 Sharpe ratio benefit at the overall strategy level. And the key here is that it's persistent in time. The strategy has shown the ability to generate a consistently lower cross-correlation between instruments relative to the more univariate approach to trend following.
In our pre-call, you mentioned that the univariate and multivariate approaches are actually, quote, mathematically linked. So there's only so much that they can deviate from one another. I was hoping you could provide some intuition for the linkage there.
Yes, that's one of the nice features as well of the strategy is that it's mathematically linked. So you can clearly attribute the returns that you get from that multivariate component. You can always move back to a univariate implementation. So between the two, there is a clear link. So it's not completely disconnected. And the link is represented by the cross-correlation relationships between the instruments we trade. It's all about correlations. And as I mentioned, because correlations are obviously not stable and vary quite a lot and are quite noisy and at times random, there will be more or less overlap between the two approaches. There's a few things we can say to illustrate a bit how it behaves relatively to each other. First of all, if you're in a market environment with very stable correlations, with a stable correlation structure, the two approaches will tend to converge and be quite aligned together. So you get less benefit of running that approach. Where you see more differences is when correlations tend to move, when you have breaks in correlation regimes, when there are big changes, shifts, then the risk positioning of the program can be quite different. And this is where we see the largest benefit. One way of also to think about it is taking a hypothetical example where you would have zero correlation structure at all between the 100 markets that we have in the universe. Think of it, zero correlation relationships, everything is uncorrelated. Then, mathematically speaking, our approach is identical to the univariate approach. So the differentiated aspect of what we do, the differentiated positioning, comes from the market correlation structure. And why is that the case? Simply because we are looking at it on a relative basis. And looking at trends on a relative basis is nothing else than modeling the correlation structure. If you do it instrument, by construction, you cannot take into account that information. And to be completely, it's not that traditional trend following doesn't take into account the correlation. Of course not, but it usually tends to happen at the second stage, the portfolio construction process.
I want to go back to your point that the flagship program has historically had a realized correlation of about 0.7 to the major trend benchmarks, high enough to probably be considered trend following, but low enough to have some meaningful differences. And I want to maybe move from the researcher hat for a moment back to the operator hat and your role as CEO and thinking about product market fit and the differentiated characteristics that your program provides versus maybe a more traditional univariate trend following program that many allocators would think of for particular uses in their portfolio. So thinking about your program for a second, how do clients build intuition for when and how you should perform given your injection of this correlation structure, especially relative to when they're thinking about allocating to other more traditional trend followers?
Yeah, I think that's a very key consideration. And we are focused or have been focused at Quantica on keeping those characteristics consistent over time. That's one of the most important features of a strategy is that you stay consistent over time so that you're predictable in terms of what the type of returns characteristics you deliver. For us, the relative approach, the main benefit of the relative approach translates into more stable returns across all types of market environments for trend. And that is striking a better balance between the exceptional performance that trend may have in very favorable trend market environments, like we have seen more lately in 2022, but as well, maybe being less exposed to the downside or to those longer periods, underwater periods that trend has tended to display in the past, to deliver as well better performance in those time periods. So striking a better balance. And the strategy has delivered makes a difference in those adverse market environments. So historically, when we look back at now almost 20 years of track record, the strategy has outperformed industry benchmarks in each of the worst 5 years for the industry since 2005. And that can be attributed, again, because you can link, obviously, you can attribute how much comes from that relative approach is attributable to the specific approach Quantica follows. Obviously, at the same time, you cannot expect from us to deliver the most astonishing performance in a year like 2022, right? Because, again, think of it like when you look at trends, because we have this relative view, we have a more balanced measure of the trend of each instrument in those instances. So historically, I think the approach has translated in an attractive Sharpe ratio. And from a research perspective, we have the ambition to target a gross Sharpe ratio of around 1. We think that for the type of liquidity we offer, that is ambitious. And we have actually come close to that number over the past 20 years. So the idea is to keep that. The idea is to keep that correlation of 0.7 and to keep those characteristics that I just described. The idea is really to provide a strategy that performs well across all types of market environments. And developing a trend system that does well in a year like 2022 is not a big deal, right? I mean, you have very simple systems that did really well in 2022 or other periods like 2014 or 2008. But the more challenging part is, what do you do in those market environments where there is no really nice trend? And intuitively, you can understand that when you look at trends from a relative basis, you generate also more opportunities to get into trends that you would not capture when you just look at each instrument on its own. So that's a bit the intuition for it. Historically, when you look at the track record, it has tended to make a big difference in those adverse market environments for trend.
So for a firm that's been around for 20 plus years, running largely the same flagship program, where do you believe that you can continue to innovate, particularly when you're constraining yourself to the space of intermediate to slow trend following?
So that's a very good question, because you might think that everything has been explored and there's only so much you can do. The reality is that we have a pipeline today that is full of research projects. I can give a bit of color in what you can do. First of all, in terms of the research philosophy, as I alluded to previously, the most important objective is to keep the style consistency so that we do not change the return characteristics of the program. And that means sticking to our core DNA. So the multivariate approach to trend, the relative approach to trend following, that is unlikely going to change. It hasn't changed in 20 years, unlikely to change going forward, because that's the DNA, that's who we are. But around that, there's a lot you can do to achieve that target Sharpe ratio, cost Sharpe ratio of 1 over the long term. And there are three areas that we distinguish. That's working on the investment universe, so looking for new trading opportunities. There's the single generation portfolio construction process, which is about, okay, how do we measure those relative trends? Once we have agreed to the framework, there are many different ways to look at this. And this is a never-ending topic. And finally, there is implementation. It's maybe less critical than on the shorter term strategies, but still, there are many different ways to approach the implementation of a trend following signal. And what is quite interesting is that we are talking here about trend signals that are medium to long term. So I mentioned like a typical quarterly look back period. How does that interact with shorter market dynamics when you get your trade onto the market? Obviously, you are not the only one. There is some overlap with other trend followers. And that is a very interesting area of research that we continue to work to this day. I'll give you examples for the different, maybe for the first two areas that I mentioned. On the investment universe, we started as a company with trading 40 markets. Today, it's a bit more than 100. It's just a reflection of a general increase in market liquidity and just new futures markets showing up. There's also today a lot more markets that are centrally cleared that you can access and for which the liquidity is continuously improving. So our objective is to keep track of these, to keep track of the liquidity, have actually accurate liquidity models in place to be able to integrate them into the strategy whenever they become liquid enough. That's one important criteria. And as of today, we are tracking more than 400 instruments that could be potential candidates for inclusion. Yet we only trade 103 because we have this focus on a homogeneous liquidity profile for a strategy. But still, that's part of the research, and that is obviously never ending. But generally, liquidity has increased. That means that that's a good thing for trend following, because you want to lower your cross correlations. And one way to lower your cross correlations is to add more uncorrelated instruments. But you need also liquidity, because otherwise you add other types of risks that might or might not be desirable. On the single and portfolio construction side, we have talked already a lot about correlations. So how you model correlations in the context of the Quantica approach is very important. There are different ways of measuring relative trends. And here the idea is to combine as many possible ways, robust ways, to get an idea of how one instrument behaves relatively to another instrument or a group of other instruments. You know, you can generalize very well. I talked about these different pairs you can form, but more generally speaking, the most general form of relative trend following is actually an instrument relative to any type of risk factor that you can identify in the market. So without going into the details, but here, you know, it's a very deep subject and there is not one way to do it. You want to do it in many different ways and combine those ways so that you get the most robust estimate of your relative trend strengths of that instrument relative to all the other instruments. And again, I mentioned on the implementation side, just one subject that I find quite interesting. It's that interaction between long-term signals and short-term market dynamics when it comes to trading. It's an interesting one.
We've touched upon the impact of correlation on your approach a number of times. I want to bring it up in the context of introducing a new market to your program, because when you're introducing a new market, it doesn't just give you something new to trade, but it provides further input to all the markets you're already trading. So how do you reduce the risk of adding a market that simply makes all the other trend signals noisier because it's making your correlation matrix harder to estimate?
Yeah, that's a very, very good question. And here we go deeper into the model. It's a very good point, and you cannot completely, I mean, you can never be sure about whether it may detract or not. I can give you a few comments on that. So first of all, it's a very interesting research area. More generally speaking, you touch on the subject that in the broadest sense, you could think of us operating on two different investment universes. There is the investment universe, the tradable investment universe, and then there is the universe that we use as signal input. And we analyze the tradable universe relative to a single universe, and those could be actually different. We could technically include all the 400 markets we trade right now as part of this signal input. Actually, to give you an example, we do offer as well a program that excludes commodity exposure. That's what we call the focus program. And here we do not filter out commodities as part of the signal. So we keep all the commodity information in the signal, but the tradable universe is smaller. So this is an example. And that's a research project on its own. And we have looked into that. What's actually the optimal signal universe that you can feed into your model? Maybe it's a universe that is composed of only five instruments. You know, as long as you capture the main asset classes, maybe that's enough. Or do you want to add more of these markets? And as you say, does it really help to add the 356 instruments? Maybe it's just detrimental and just adds noise. So the way we have solved that is that the solution is unlikely to be in the selection. So making a selection, the question is, okay, which instruments do you select, which ones you don't? I speak also from a personal experience over the years, also from the shorter term side. I think you want to avoid, in quant, you want to avoid introducing selection bias as much as possible. You rather try to introduce some tilting, weighting between the instruments to avoid, because selection is always biased in a way. So in that sense, our model, we believe, is robust actually to whether we add another 20 instruments, it's unlikely to be detrimental because it's taken care of in the way we weigh and group those different instruments together. They are obviously bucketed. There are subsectors that have share more correlations. So you want to make sure that you don't get imbalances between all these and you balance them correctly. So far, yeah, we try to avoid selecting here on the signal universe side to avoid introducing these biases.
To just draw on that point a little, naively, I would imagine that if you weren't to appropriately weight and adjust, you could just have more commodity contracts than, say, equity contracts, and then you'd be over-influenced by the correlations to commodities. You are looking to balance, handcraft in a way, balance that risk in the signal generation.
Exactly, because if you add 30 commodities, and you know, the reality is that when you look at the next 300 markets, a lot are commodities. Commodities is by far the deepest universe with a lot of opportunities, and you just don't want that type of correlations to start dominating your approach. But there are ways, obviously, and the weighting schemes are important to take into account. You don't blindly add instruments here. But at the same time, you would be tempted to make a selection, but that's also dangerous because it introduces a lot of biases.
Well, on this topic of markets being added to a trend program, whether it's in the signal side or the trading side, right? You talked about this example of maybe it just takes five markets to capture the majority of the latent features, or maybe you should use all 300. I want to spend some time on your recent Q1 2024 insight piece, which was titled Trend Following and Risk Factor Diversification in 2022 and 2023, A Tale of Two Extremes. First, I want to say everyone listening should go subscribe to your quarterly insights. I have really enjoyed them. This one, I think, will be a piece that I end up referencing for the next 5 to 10 years. I think it's a very clever, well done piece. And it had some really novel analysis. And so before we dive into it, maybe to set the table, you can provide some context for the research questions you were trying to answer in this piece and how you went about doing it.
Yeah, sure. Thanks for the kind words. I really appreciate it. Yeah, we try to publish a paper every quarter, and we have this internal joke within the team that, I mean, like, we're serious about it, actually. We only publish a paper if we learn something in the process. Otherwise, it's not worth publishing. So that's what drives us. It's for our investors. So it's not necessarily meant for just a quant audience, but for the broadest possible audience. So about that paper, the idea came up at the end of last year with the observation that we just got out of two extremely different years, 2022 and 2023. And trend following is actually quite fascinating, right? 2022, I think, was, based on certain metrics, was the best year for trend following since 2000 or maybe something like that. And 2023, it was the worst. If you look at it from an excess return perspective, so without the cash contribution, I think 2023 was pretty bad. How is it that you move from one of the best trend environments in decades to the worst all within 24 months? That was the starting point. And there is some intuition, obviously, because we have been trading that every day. So you know where your opportunities were in 2022. Obviously, trend following gathered a lot of attention because bonds, equities were down and trended really well. In the end, you can boil it down to one trade and take any trend manager, any CTA, the short bond exposure accounts for a lot of the P&L that was generated in 2022. That was the case for us, but that was the case in general for an industry. It was all about that short bond trade that was driven by the persistent rise in interest rates in 2022 and the continued underestimation of the markets of the future path of interest rates, right? That's the perfect setup for medium to long-term trend following. That's the perfect example of what you're looking after as a trend follower. And the thing is that it was not just the rise in interest rates, obviously, that reverberated across all asset classes because equities. So the high inflation obviously led to a stronger positive correlation between equities and bonds, which means that equities fell in tandem with bonds. That also was a bit a new thing, right? That positive, persistently positive correlation between equities and bonds. The dollar strengthened, markets trend followers are active in. So you made money actually through that trade, rise in interest rates across many different markets. That's the intuition. 2023. None of that. I mean, interest rates reached new highs, but we had a bit of an issue as trend followers. We had two large reversals on the fixed income side. First, the banking crisis in March, the typical worst case scenario for a trend follower. You came out of 22 again with that very large short bond position, external shock, yields pull back, and obviously you get to close your position, which was quite painful. Yields rose again, and in the November, after reaching 5%, the 10-year treasury in the US, we had again a larger pullback because of the repricing of the interest rate expectations in the US. So in a nutshell, there was no money to be made with fixed income or any actually cost asset global macro factor that year. But if you look at, for instance, in our case, but also more generally speaking, I think these were markets that were quite profitable in 2023. We found very different entities. So for instance, on the commodity side, obviously there was already cocoa before it became mainstream this year. Cocoa was a very strong contributor. Markets like sugar, wheat, rapeseed. On the energy side, we had European and US natural gas. These were short positions. Metals side, we had iron ore, which is a very China-driven market. On the currency side, if you just look at the two main contributors on our side, it was the Japanese yen and the Mexican peso. Yen was a persistent weakening of the currency relative to the dollar. The Mexican peso was a long position, so completely different drivers of returns. So if you look at that, trend opportunities in 2023 were entirely driven by what you could call actually market-specific local risk factors. Whatever affects the price of cocoa is unlikely to affect any of the financial markets we trade. That's what you can call it again, idiosyncratic risk factors in a sense. 2022 was all about one large macro cost asset factor that reverberated across all asset classes. So that was the observation. Now, as a quant, what you like to do is there a way to quantify it in a neat and clear way? And that's more difficult than thought often because we deal with financial markets and every effect that you are observing is very weak by definition. And it's often very difficult actually to quantify an intuition that you get from trading these markets every day. Nevertheless, we thought we'd give it a try and try to come up with that result that we published and ultimately in that publication. And so the idea was that instead of looking at just instrument return contribution, would try to decompose the P&L of a trend follower according to a set of independent risk factors, statistical risk factors, because that's ultimately what counts. Okay, how many independent sources of returns were you capitalizing on? Because when you are long the dollar, short bonds, long oil and short equity in 2022, it's one and the same trade. I mean, it's one risk factor that through the correlations dynamics plays out in favor of your trend follower. So such a decomposition essentially can be nicely done by a principal component analysis. That's what PCA does, right? It identifies a list of uncorrelated and independent statistical risk factors, which are called the principal components. And so with that methodology, we transformed the instrument P&L attribution into a performance attribution on risk factors, on statistical risk factors defined as these principal components. This enables you to define and calculate an effective number of risk factors explaining your trend P&L. There are different ways to do that. We chose to use the Shannon entropy, which is a known measure to capture the shape of a distribution in one number. And that number is anywhere between 1 and n, so n being the size of your investment universe. And if you have a super diversified investment universe, your Shannon entropy or the number of effective independent factors explaining your P&L is going to be more towards 100 if you have 100 instruments. And essentially, if all your P&L is explained by one single risk factor, it's going to be 1. So that's how you interpret the number. And we run it on 2022 and 2023. So on our trend replication, we have an internal trend replication, benchmark trend replication model to see, okay, how does it look like? And intuition got confirmed, where you see that for 2022, essentially you see that there's one statistical risk factor that shows up and dominates everything else. And if you look at the components of that statistical risk factor, because every principal component is a combination of the 100 instruments that make up your investment universe, unsurprisingly, you see that it's heavily driven by short positions and all the fixed income positions, which is nice and confirms the intuitions. And in 2023, it's quite the opposite. I think we measured up to 33 different risk factors that were needed to replicate the P&L of our trend following strategy. So in 1 year, you just need 1, 2, 3, actually, to be precise, I think our number was 7 for 2022 to replicate around 90% of the P&L of a generic trend following approach. In 2023, it was 33. And the reason is it's related to the market observations I provided just before.
What I loved about this paper, or one, the results I thought were fascinating, but two, I thought the approach was profoundly elegant and clever. Because one, once you understand it, I mean, I think I implemented it in 100 lines of Python. Like once you get the math, it's something that is very easy to do. And two, it's very generic. While your exploration was of trend following, as long as you have the weights of your instruments and the returns of those instruments, you can apply this framework to any sort of investment strategy, whether it's trend following or long short equity or whatever it is. And it answers the same question, which was how many statistical risk factors were driving my return? Now, what was so interesting about your results, in my opinion, was the negative relationship that emerged between trend following performance and the number of risk factors driving performance in a given year. So as the title of the piece alluded to, 2022 and 2023 seem to be polar opposite ends of the spectrum here. 2022, a low number of risk factors with a very high return. 2023, a high number of arguably idiosyncratic risk factors with a much worse return profile. In your opinion, what's sort of the intuition for this result? And what do you think the takeaway for practitioners is?
Yeah, let's say the most striking result of this paper was when we then tried to generalize it. So once we looked at it for 2022 and 2023, validating our intuition, the next natural step was to see, okay, how does that compare to historical numbers since 2000? So we run it for every calendar year since 2000. And strikingly, first of all, 2023 was the year in 24 years where you needed the highest number of independent risk factors to replicate trend following performance. Amazing, right? So there was no other year over the past 24 years where so many different factors were required. Actually, approximately 30%. So the number of factors was corresponding to approximately 30% of your investment universe size. And at the same time, 2022, there was only one year where less factors were required to explain, to replicate the performance of a trend follower. That was 2008. Maybe it doesn't come as a surprise here as well. It was an extreme year where trend following also performed very well. So that was really interesting. And then more generally, as you alluded to, as you highlighted, one of the results in the paper is that there is this very nice inverse relationship between the level of trend following performance and the number of independent risk factors required to explain that performance. And there is maybe something that is a bit counterintuitive at first, but it's not at all, is that trend following performs always best when you have these big cross-asset macro factors and very few idiosyncratic factors explaining your P&L. So it goes a bit against the principle at first sight that investment universe diversification is beneficial. Actually, if you want to have these stellar years with trend, you need some sort of macro factor that is driving, that's reverberating across all these different markets. And you can see that years that have been difficult for trend following in the past, like 2012, 2018, and more lately 2023. In each of these years, we see that there were more idiosyncratic factors at play that drove the most profitable trends relative to those macro factors that were not there. And in years like 08, 2022, or a year like 2010, they have been historically among the best years in the industry. Here, you had very few risk factors required to explain the trend P&L. So one takeaway for investors from that analysis is that investment universe diversification actually does matter, but it matters for in times of adverse market environments for trend following. When you don't have those large cross-asset macro factors that drive your trend P&L, you will rely on investment universe diversification to uncover all these idiosyncratic trends, because there's only so much P&L you can extract out of a single market, right? For risk management purpose, you don't want to allocate 20% of your risk to cocoa. We don't do that. Maybe some do it, but we don't. You want to keep that diversification. And the more diversified you are, the more markets you trade, the more likely you are to capture some of those idiosyncratic driven trends like cocoa, because it has been quite a topic in recent weeks. But the larger the investment universe is for a trend follower, the greater the potential to identify and exploit a wider range of trends driven by different risk factors that will lead basically to a more robust approach in the long term. At the opposite, in a year like 2022, when you have that rise in interest rates, you can actually operate probably with a universe of five assets again. Like, we are back at that number. Five assets is probably enough. If you capture the main asset classes, you capture the general trend, right? So investment universe diversification doesn't really matter in those years. But you see historically over the past 20 years, every great year can probably be explained by one of these large cross-asset macro factors.
Do you think that this research suggests that trend followers who over the last decade have made a large push to increase their investment universe, not just into the fatter tail of alternative markets, but you see them starting to include synthetic markets as well, right? Many trend followers have been talking about that being a huge push over the last decade. Is the risk there that they actually over-diversify themselves away from the big macro themes because all those other markets are going to behave more idiosyncratically and take risk capital away, and therefore those trend programs will behave less similarly to trend programs of the past during macro environments?
Yes. So beyond the paper we wrote in that you referred to, that's actually the next chapter. So to elaborate on your thoughts, I tend to agree that you can see it as a trade-off. Like, so the larger your investment universe becomes, that means that you are going towards more illiquid markets. The more illiquid markets you trade, these markets, they will tend to be driven by more idiosyncratic and less macro factor or risk factors. And so that means that the larger the proportion of instrument is in your universe, that assumes that you allocate a meaningful risk to these instruments, the more idiosyncratic risk factor exposure you will get, and maybe to the detriment of your exposure to these large macro factors. So it can be seen as a trade-off. And then the macro factors clearly contribute towards the convexity of trend following. The trends driven by idiosyncratic risk factors will help your Sharpe ratio. So we can see it as a balance between how much convexity you want to have and how much you care about your Sharpe ratio. And so what's the optimal solution here? I think that that's left also with investor preferences. When it comes to us, as I mentioned before, we tend to focus clearly on the most liquid instrument side, and in that way, strike the right balance between how much of these idiosyncratic risk factor-driven trends you capture and how much of those macro-driven factors you capitalize on.
What's interesting to me is, right, you do seem to have this trade-off between what you call convexity, sensitivity to these macro drivers versus the robustness of the program, which is very much tied to the fundamental law of active management, right? That we want to increase diversification, all else held equal. And it seems to me like the balance we can think about numerically, but also going back again, putting on your operator hat in this product market fit. And maybe you can talk me through your thinking from that perspective as you talk to allocators and how they're looking to use these programs, how you think about that trade-off of more diversification probably means it's a much more robust absolute return type strategy, but less likely to do well or have the big outlier years in a 2022 versus the benefit of that convexity that's going to give those really big outlier years that some investors may be trying to use the program for.
Yeah, absolutely. This is a crucial thought process to have that every CTA should have. When it comes to us, we have a clear view about that. I mean, first of all, I think ultimately there is no right and wrong here. It's really a question of investor preference. The way we look at it from a product position perspective is our flagship program is focused on the most liquid markets, and we seek to offer investors a homogeneous liquidity profile. That means that how do we incorporate an instrument into the investment universe? It's all relative. That means that no instrument that we trade should have an outsized contribution to the overall implementation cost. That's how we define whether a market is eligible to be integrated or not. So that assumes having a good knowledge of the cost structure of those markets and then looking at it from that relative perspective. So it's not an absolute liquidity metric. It's really, okay, if we add, let's say, 1/100th of the portfolio risk to that new instrument, what's the percentage contribution to total implementation costs in the long run? And that needs to be balanced, and that provides a homogeneous risk and liquidity profile for our investors that is quite deterministic in terms of what to expect. So the way we look at the combination of the more idiosyncratic trends that would be driven by those instruments, maybe a bit less liquid, is from a segregated perspective. So ideally, you run two programs. You have a liquid program and a less liquid program, and that allows you actually to allocate your risk accordingly to your preferences. For instance, you can think of maybe, or the way maybe we would look at it is allocating 80% to, let's say, traditional trends focused on those 100 most common markets within the trend space, within the CTA space, and 20% to, let's say, a specific trend program applied that will focus more on the idiosyncratic risk factors. And then you have this balance between the nice convexity profile of trend following that delivers you that negative beta relative to equities when you need it most, right? But at the same time, achieving that nice diversification that will deliver you additional performance in times when, let's say, traditional trend following struggles a bit more. So that's one way of looking at it. I think there is no one solution to it. We continuously review, obviously, the opportunity set. And yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how that evolves also into 2024 and over the next couple of years. What you tend to see is that every year is different, right, from what drives your trend P&L, and that makes this job so fascinating.
Well, Nicola, we come to the end of the episode here, and I'm asking every guest this season the same final question, which is, what are you obsessed with today? And this can be something from research or a book or a movie or a new hobby or, heck, even a conspiracy theory. But what really got your attention today that you're focused on?
That's a good question. I mean, ultimately, obsessed with delivering the best possible product that's out there, right? It's about making sure that we are not missing anything. And that's not necessarily on the investment side, right? Running an asset management business is quite a complex task, has become more and more complex over the years, but it's a fascinating endeavor. We have the chance to be an independent company that puts a lot of responsibility on us. And I think in a role like mine, you're obsessed at not making mistakes and making sure that our client base is happy with the results and that they get what they expect from us. It's obsessed with challenging what we do. I think you need to stay humble and always question whether what you do is the best way. that's what research is all about, and is not stopping at any point in time. Just keep challenging what you do and have the team on board with that approach. So to never rest on what you have achieved so far and just continuously challenging your approach. Markets, make sure to bring you back to earth every now and then, right? To stay humble and just to keep on pushing to produce the best possible product for investors. That's what I've done basically for 20 years, and I hope that we can do it for many more years to come.
Well, Nicola, thank you so much for joining me and sharing these insights. It's great to get another trend follower doing things in a novel and unique way. And I'm sure there's a lot of folks who will listen to this episode with interest and get a lot of really interesting nuggets for them to go back and explore. So thank you.
Corey, thank you very much for having us today. It was a great pleasure speaking with you.